Conservative.
Christian. Mother. Wife.
Air Force veteran.
Gun rights advocate.
This is Stacey on the Right. Here's your host, Stacey Washington.
Welcoming back to the program, one of our esteemed guests, Sergeant Betsy Brantner Smith, retired. She is a spokesperson for the National Police Association. We are so glad to have you here, Sergeant Betsy. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Stacey. It's great to be with you tonight.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. We've had a number of shootings across the country, and now we have the shooting at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Let's just run down them one by one. What can you tell us, updates, anything fresh about the North Carolina at Chapel Hill shooting?
Well, we are finding out more about the suspect who has been charged, with murder and with bringing a gun onto an educational property, which I think that, and the fact that he used the gun elevated that to a felony as well. So we presume that he is going to spend his life in prison. He murdered an associate professor who was also one of his advisors. So this was a very targeted attack. It was a personal attack. And, of course, this was a very frightening situation when this went down. You know, gunfire was heard, and the authorities did a great job of locking down the university. And then there was a fantastic multi-agency police response because he was, on the run for a short amount of time. He threw the handgun somewhere, and they were able to bring him into custody a little bit later. But this looks like it's a very targeted attack. Now, the suspect, Eli Q, I'm not sure I'm saying that correctly. He was kind of a mid-level graduate student, not the best student. A lot of the other students are saying was in the same lab group with the victim. Wasn't a guy that was in trouble very often. He had a couple of speeding tickets. But we still haven't heard the entire motive of why he did this.
So I think we'll learn more as time goes on, but I think your assessment, it kind of paints a picture of something that they don't seem as if the people who knew him that have so far spoken with law enforcement, like this was an expected action, like he'd been in trouble before where they would say, oh, yeah, I could see him doing this. It doesn't sound like he was in that position.
No, and we may see, whether it's academic issues, perhaps he and Professor Yan didn't agree on things. We really don't know. There were some rumors, I'm sure you saw it too, on Twitter where there were some tweets that were attributed to his account talking about, an unidentified female. Was this really his Twitter account? You never really know those things when things come out. And perhaps there were some writings in his apartment. But so far law enforcement, as they conduct this investigation, have not released a motive. But one of the things I want people to really think about as they watched that police response, I was on an airplane when this was all going down, and we saw the live videos on Twitter and on television. In fact, I jumped on one of the networks to talk about the tactical response. When you have a situation like this, especially on a campus with an identified suspect who is not in custody, you've got to think about, are there more suspects? It's something we call the plus one rule. Are there more suspects? Are there more weapons? Are there explosives? Could there be multiple scenes? In other words, and this, of course, this goes back to Columbine, where two young people shot up their high school, but outside the high school, they planted multiple bombs. Fortunately, they weren't very good bomb makers, so they didn't go off. But that's something with the law enforcement response That's what we immediately think about and start to plan for. It's not just the shooting scene itself, but everything around it, especially when we are talking about a campus. So we are really, the National Police Association are so, we're so proud of this multi-agency immediate law enforcement response to the shooting. And then the suspect was taken into custody very quickly. So I want people to be really proud of the law enforcement response in this situation.
It sounds like they were in the right place. They responded quickly and they used their training well to minimize the situation and then also to, you know, to bring this individual to justice.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we are, you know, this is something that law enforcement constantly trains for, you know, sadly. And, you know, the suspect had, he had a 9mm handgun. We haven't heard the details of where he obtained it, how he obtained it. But he's a man apparently with no criminal history and no mental health history that has been released yet. So he would certainly be able to legally obtain a firearm. And he chose to use it to, you know, for evil. And that's what, when we talk, you know, because of course, you know, when we talk about these shootings, everybody wants to talk about gun control. Remember, the law on that campus was no firearms. So he chose to break the law by bringing a firearm to campus. And then, of course, he chose to murder an innocent person. More gun laws are not going to affect the evil in someone's heart.
Nor will they help if the person is in a gun-free zone where they can operate with impunity. They don't have to worry about anyone there having a firearm to shoot them back. So no deterrent.
Well, and I'll tell you, this is one of the things that you know, I talked about when, you know, while the shooting was being responded to. These gun-free zones and gun-free campuses, frankly, are a danger to students because of exactly what you just said. He can walk into the lecture hall where he went in, the science building, to kill this professor, knowing full well that if he doesn't run into law enforcement or security, that he's probably not going to run into somebody with a firearm. And, you know, we saw this in the Michigan shooting, you know, was it Western Michigan shooting? And we've seen this time and time again. You know, years ago, I got the opportunity to visit Hillsdale College in Michigan. And they have, not only do they allow, if you are properly permitted and have legally obtained a firearm as a student, you may carry a firearm, you know, as long as you comply with the laws of the state of Michigan. And I was able to talk to some of the students there, and they have a terrific practice facility, a beautiful range that they've built there. And the students, especially the female students, just felt so much safer knowing that they could carry a firearm and knowing that some of their friends chose to carry firearms. They felt free to move about the campus. And then we talk about these gun-free schools, but I think it's a terrible idea, especially when you're talking about a college campus where presumably everyone's an adult.
Right, and where we now have incontrovertible evidence that these locations are chosen because they have all of those gun-free zone signs. The bad guys are literally saying, well, you know, if we're going to do it, we might as well do it where we don't have to worry about getting hurt. It's a ringing endorsement for taking those signs down.
It absolutely is. You know, if you're old enough to go to college, if you're old enough to live on your own, then presumably you are old enough to be responsible with a firearm if you choose so. And I know, I'm sure there are parents who are listening who are, you know, about to or just have sent their 18-year-old up to college and they're thinking, geez, you know, I don't think I want my 18-year-old carrying a gun on campus. And that's fine. You know, if you're going to, I mean, you know this, Stacey, if you're going to carry a firearm, then you have got to be trained and you've got to be responsible. And I am certainly not saying, you know, I got four kids. I'm not sure any of them at age 18 would have been the person that I wanted to put a handgun in their hand while they were at college. But every one of my kids, by the time they were 18, was already a shooter and a hunter, and they knew how to be responsible with firearms, you know. And when, I mean, you can go back, and I'm going to sound like my father, you know, you go back to when I was a kid, mm-hmm. and, you know, we all knew the power of a firearm. We all knew how to use them, and we all knew how to protect ourselves if we needed to, whether we were at home or in our vehicle. It was a very different time, and it seems like, you know, we have far more gun laws in this country now than ever before, and yet it seems to be we have far more incidents of gun crime.
Well, far more guns and far less training, far fewer children who graduate from high school with the credentials you just named off. Most kids graduate, they've never even held a firearm unloaded. They've never fired one. Our kids were in gun club in middle school, and it was a club at their school. Mm-hmm. And they took the Eddie Eagle safety class. They learned about firearm safety, and they got to fire all kinds of different firearms at the gun range. And so, you know, they haven't hunted. I mean, they haven't done quite as much as your kids have, but at very minimum, they know that you never point a firearm at someone unless you're planning on using it. You never put your booger picker on, you know, the trigger unless you're planning on pulling it. There are a few just basic safety things. If you see a firearm, you never pick it up, not even to examine it, not even to see if it's you know, if it's loaded. These are things that kids used to learn at school because it was thought of as, you know, common sense to make sure that everybody knew how to be safe around firearms. Now they instill fear in people, and so some people have fear, some people have fascination, and usually the ones with the fascination are the ones who have evil intent. They're fascinated with firearms because they want to hurt people, and they usually end up being able to do that because they haven't been taught otherwise. And you couple an immoral society with a proliferation of firearms, which I have no problem with it, because the criminals proliferate with the firearms. They steal them, they traffic them, they do whatever they want. So I have no problem with there being a proliferation, but I do have a problem with an immoral society that doesn't teach children and young adults how to use them and how to treat firearms as proper tools. And then we have these situations that keep cropping up, which only benefit the gun control nuts.
You know, Stacey, I was at a meeting recently where someone was talking and saying, you know, we should teach gun safety rules in the schools for children because maybe we wouldn't have all these accidental shootings. And I just had to laugh because I said, we had a fantastic program called the Eddie Eagle program. The person said, tell me about that. So I explained, stop, don't touch, leave the area, tell an adult. I said, there was the entity that made this program did a cartoon with a very popular kids character and all that. And then when we were done having this conversation, they said, who is it that developed this program? And I said, the NRA. And of course, then that was it. Well, we can't do it because of the Eagle NRA.
We hate the NRA.
Yeah.
We hate them.
People don't remember that the NRA developed that program for exactly what you and I are talking about, but they got one out of the schools for political reasons.
Well, politics, if used improperly, kills. And these are the examples we have, because when there were gun racks on the back of a lot of the cars in the parking lot at school, and most middle school and high schools, the kids drove themselves to school, they had their gun racks and their rifles because they had, you know, shooting club after school, target practice, all kinds of different clubs for guns. We didn't have school shootings. We really didn't. I mean, I don't know if it's because the parents were better back then, or because if you were a bully, you got suspended. Or you might get your butt kicked by the kid you're bullying's dad, you know, at your own house. I'm not sure what the difference is, but there are differences. And they're pretty obviously the wrong differences because we're getting the wrong results.
We truly are. And as you know, we're talking about, you know, a couple of the more notorious, you know, shootings over the week and weekend. But of course, every week and weekend in this country, there are multiple shootings, multiple murders, especially in cities like New Orleans, St. Louis, Chicago, Philadelphia, Baltimore, LA, Seattle, and it never seems to end. And it is, you know, there are multiple reasons, but a lot of it is because people absolutely have hate in their hearts. And you combine that with a lack of a prosecution, with a absolute lack of respect for life, and we're going to continue to see this.
And then we're going to continue to see calls for gun control. And I want there to be a better way for us to live, and a better thing that we can understand. So I want to move on to the next shooting while we have you here. Sergeant Betsy Brantner Smith, retired. She's the spokesperson for the National Police Association. If you're just joining us, I certainly think if you've been listening to the show for a while, you recognize Sergeant Betsy's voice. Talk to us about this racially motivated shooting at the Dollar General in Jacksonville.
So this is such a horrific shooting on Saturday. A 21-year-old man, Ryan Palmeter, who has been getting psychiatric help. He had been on medication, although the investigation shows that he's probably now gotten off that medication. He had been previously suicidal. He had been previously Baker-acted, which that means in Florida, to be Baker-acted means you were involuntarily committed for at least a brief period of time to a mental health facility or a hospital receive mental health care. He basically took off. He first went to Edward Waters University, which is a historically black college, and he got to campus. He started to put on a vest and gloves, hat and a mask, and some of the students saw him. They alerted security and university security, uniform security, tried to approach him, and he took off, but they alerted police authorities. He then went to a Family Dollar store where there was a security guard, and he left that, and he went, unfortunately, to a Dollar General where he started shooting people. He shot a patron. He shot a store worker. He shot another person, and in the middle of this shooting, after he had started, he texted his father, and he said, go into my room, look at, you know, some things I have there. I have a will, I have a note, and he had basically written a manifesto that said that he hated black people and that he was going to kill black people. The manifesto has not been released. But the contents has been spoken about by the police department, so we know, and we knew very quickly the motivation. And his motivation was hate. And he, as law enforcement responded, he turned his AR-15 on himself and committed suicide, but not before murdering three people.
So the parents had obviously, they were aware that he had some issues, and they'd, you know, had the Baker Act used on him. But then he was able to, after having that interaction, he was still able to go out and buy firearms lawfully. So the Baker Act doesn't have a lasting impact on your ability to buy firearms in the future.
Apparently not, and we don't know the exact method of how he obtained a firearm. We're told that he purchased it legally, but if he did it, you know, at a any kind of a gun store or gun show, he would have had to fill out federal paperwork, and on that federal form, it asks, "Have you or are you being treated for a mental illness?" So. You know, we hear a lot of talk about you need, you know, universal background checks and things like that. Understand that people lie on those forms. And so if he did buy it through a federal firearms deal, a dealer, obviously he lied on the form. Now, if he got it privately, he wouldn't have to fill out that form. But his parents apparently knew that he had firearms. They also knew that he had some mental health issues. And his parents have been very cooperative. You know, his dad called 911 right after getting that text and going in and reading the manifesto. And we, the National Police Association, wants people to really understand how quickly the contents of this manifesto was released, you know, not the actual document, but law enforcement immediately said, here's the motivation. And that is so helpful to the investigators. It's helpful to law enforcement in other areas that are not involved with this case. And remember, we're the organization that is suing and still hoping to get the National Covenant School Manifesto, where the transgender woman went in, murdered both children and faculty at the National Covenant School. We still, Stacey, haven't seen that manifesto, don't know the details of it, because presumably it's in the hands of the FBI, and they have yet to release it, and Nashville PD has yet to release it, too. So we really applaud the law enforcement authorities in Florida for releasing the contents so that people immediately knew that this is an evil guy who's a racist, who's got hate in his heart, and this was the motivation for murdering these three people.
It is good, the speed with which they were able to do that. We still are waiting and very grateful to National Police Association for your work and your continued diligence in trying to get the Covenant Manifesto. We have no desire. I've not met one person. I've not talked to one person who has a desire to be salacious with the contents of that. But whatever needs to be redacted or whatever condition they need to put it into to get it out there, we can't have one standard for people who shoot people and another standard for transgender people who shoot people. The standard has to be the same. If we always let the manifesto out or the contents or the essential information from the contents, if we always let that out, then we always let it out. It's one or the other. Before we let you go, and Sergeant Betts, we are so grateful for your time, there was an attack on a Connecticut police officer by a hammer-wielding man. This story has not gotten as much play because of the two shootings that we just covered. Tell us what happened here.
So we had a female police officer who went to, basically she got a call of a domestic dispute, and she goes to the domestic dispute and makes contact with a man with a hammer, and she does an excellent job, this all on body camera, of trying to de-escalate this man, but he ultimately attacks her with a claw hammer, which is in police training, we consider that a deadly weapon. And there was, you know, one of the things we're seeing now with police officers is a hesitation very often to use deadly force and to continue to verbally de-escalate or use something like a taser, pepper spray, things like that, which none of this worked on this man. So this female officer got attacked with a claw hammer. She was finally able to get to her firearm and fire enough rounds that this guy at least ran away. I mean, she put rounds on him. Shooting somebody is not like on television. So just because you put a bullet or two or 10 into somebody doesn't mean that they fall over. And he was able to get away. She's injured, but will be able to return to duty. And he's in custody. But again, this is a man with, a claw hammer, you know, a heavy duty hammer. And this was a situation, a domestic dispute, not a quote-unquote nonviolent domestic dispute at the time it was dispatched, that a lot of agencies like Seattle are talking about not sending any police officers and simply sending social workers. And this case in Connecticut really shows us why it's a terrible idea to send unarmed social workers by themselves to calls like domestic disputes. And we are so grateful that this officer is going to recover. But this was a horrific situation for her and for her agency.
Wow. And so you're saying she shot him?
She did shoot him.
It just didn't
but
help.
Did not kill him. And that is not uncommon. My husband has interviewed hundreds of police officers involved in deadly force situations. And the number one thing that they have told him over the decades is as they were firing at someone, their first thought was, I'm missing. Because we're all sort of conditioned to, you know, even cops, you know, we think it's going to be like on TV where the TV cop pulls out a gun, fires one round, the bad guy flies back, and the shooting is over. And that's not how it happens. And you know, so this officer, once she was able to use her firearm, put, I believe, multiple rounds on this suspect, and he was able to run into his home.
After having been shot more than one time, and the standard issue for a firearm issue for law enforcement is 9mm.
Right, either, you know, some cops carry a, you know, something with a, maybe a 45, but, you know, presumably she was probably carrying a 9mm Glock or some other sort of handgun. And again, she was trying to de-escalate this man. She was trying to talk him into dropping the hammer. You know, she did, you know, I encourage everybody to go and look up the body camera and just take a look at it. She tries really hard, and that's what we're trained to do. No cop wakes up in the morning and says, oh, I hope I get to go shoot somebody today. She really did a great job of trying to talk this guy down. You know, he was extremely agitated. But when he attacked her, you know, she continued to try to calm him down, but ultimately she had no choice but to utilize deadly force. And we continue to, you know, keep her in our prayers because she's, you know, an attack with a hammer is a very damaging instrument.
Right. Wow. All right. So I think it's really important, the conversation we just had. There's a lot of people out there who truly believe that, you know, the reason no one should have more than 6 rounds in any kind of gun is because one or two shots, the person is either on the ground or they're flying back. And there are lots of videos online of real shootings where one shot and the person drops dead. That can happen. But there's also the phenomenon you've described, which law enforcement officers have described again and again and again, where an assailant has been shot and they're still coming. They're still coming for the officer. And so deadly force really becomes, you know, it's an exercise in how much deadly force they're going to need to use to stop the suspect. And they'll say, well, why did they have to use so many bullets? Well, because the person was still moving. The person was still coming. And if officers have seen that before, then they are more likely, if they shoot 2 rounds and the person's still coming, to then unload their firearm. And anyone who's with them, I mean, it's a phenomenon you're describing that sounds unreal. You shoot someone multiple times and they keep moving around. They don't stop. That's something that once an officer has seen that, it's going to change their calculus on what they need to do. And so these are just different situations that we have to be aware of. And it's so important. I can't stress it enough how important it is that we begin to understand that there's more than one paradigm at play for these officers when they're in the line of duty.
And that's why we need our police leaders to stand up whenever their officers are involved in an officer-involved shooting and explain the dynamics at hand. Very often we see police leaders who are sort of hesitant to talk about, you know, the even the physics behind the situation. Mm-hmm. And but we owe it to the American public to explain, you know, why did that officer empty his magazine into that guy? Well, here's the explanation, and it's a very simple science-based explanation, and we've got to think about adrenaline, we've got to think about drugs. You know, there have been police officers that have been killed by people that were dying, that had been shot multiple times and were dying, but the bad guy is still able to get enough rounds on a police officer to kill them. So, you know, everybody loves to watch cop shows, but we need to know that that's not the reality of using deadly force as a police officer and having deadly force used on you.
Yep, because the fact is the officer wants to come home alive, and the assailant, oftentimes that person is really working up towards suicide by cop anyway. That doesn't mean they all are, but in some cases they are. They have decided they're not going home alive, and they don't care who they take with them. So just different paradigms that we need to be aware of as we listen to these stories and as we consume them. And instead of jumping to the gun, bad officer or bad shoots, let's not do that. Let's find out as much as we can about the circumstances. Sergeant Betsy Brander-Smith, your expertise, unmatched, and we are so blessed to have access to you to come on our show and to unpack these stories and to give the perspective, the proper perspective on these. So grateful for your time tonight and for the National Police Association. The website is nationalpolice.org, nationalpolice.org. Thank you, Sergeant Betsy.
Thanks, Stacey. Can't wait to talk to you again.
All right. Talk to you soon. Thank you so much. She's out there working. I mean, it's nonstop. Not only does she issue a lot of information and detailed statistics to those of us in media, but she also provides her expertise on radio and television, and then she is a spokesperson for National Police. So she's out there informing, training, lots to do, and so she's so great at it. We're grateful for her here at Stacey on the Right.